Horsham at an art college, and nobody ever likes to speak at an art college, really. They're not really capable of it. So a friend introduced me by standing up and saying, that's Tom Clark. Sat down again, which is as succinct a way of doing it as any, I suppose. I'm going to start in the way that I always start, by reading a poem called A Dedication. And this is just a long list of objects, images, things that crop up throughout the rest of my poetry. They're simply things that I like, and it seems to me that the sort of essential thing of poetry is that it simply is a list or a naming of things that the poet wants to celebrate. So this is called A Dedication. To the first celandine, to wood smoke and slow bloom, to the seven notes of the spectrum, to the syllable on the heart's tongue, to frost and fragrance, to the table spread for light, to apples, pears, and pebbles, to quiet in its kernel of silence, to the sedge at the water's edge, to the mountain's infinite number of profiles, to brook and thrush in spate, to the song in the shining tree, to the bugle and the dry fountain, to the bicycle chained with convolvulus, to the distance between things, to the metamorphosis of the comma, to the northern side of the valley, to herb Paris undiscovered, to the sunbeams among the glances, to the blue rose, to the harvest of facts, to the robin in its armor of song, to the quiet roofs and the glittering eaves, to Madder Lake and raw Sienna, to all the discarded adjectives, to the melody behind parting clouds, to deep shade fashioned out of light, to all the anonymous places where couch grass grows, to the single larch in the forest of pine, to the oar dipped in clarity, to the wild garden neglected, to grace descending through the blue, to wood grain and marble vein, to the necessary thistle, to the gestures settling like a snow, to the clavichord and the mountain stream, to the bright threshold, to the halo round the word, to each small decision of attention, to morning air in a parcel of mint, to margins and boundaries, to the style on the horizon, to the deer concealed and the stag revealed, to faults, fractures, and erratics, to the dictionary in its secluded glade, to the rain of blossom, to the stubble of affections, to high cumulus and calm, to the lifted hills and the prostrate valley, to the proverb that sharpens the plough, to the book of hours, to the lime-washed dwellings, to the dew in the lichen cups, to measure, stress, and quantity, to the thorn in bloom, to the lost tintinnabulation of the harebell, to the fields standing in order, to summits and altitudes, to the advancing bracken, to the last gleam in the gloaming. I think that just about everything else I'm going to read is unpublished as yet, but most of it about to be so. This is a little collection of poems which I'm hoping to bring out soon as one of my own Moscatel Press publications. It's a book called The Hollow Way, and it's a series of 12-line poems, and they've all got a fairly strict rhyming pattern to them. I think that in all except the last couple of poems, the way that they're formed is that each line is taken as a unit, and there's no sort of movement from line to line, although the separate lines make up a fairly recognisable landscape of one kind or another. The first one is a sort of interior. Freshness gathers in a jar. The evening waits on splendour. We have come home from war. Only the indigent wander. Ask nothing of life. The hours have no halter. The garden gate is ajar. Purpose does not falter. Abundance ripens in a bowl. The telephone rings in an empty room. A turbulence of trapped wings. In the corner reclines a broom. Awkward are the hills. The lark is born from the furrow. Word grazes against word. Keep old trust from sorrow. Impetuous are the rills. Let us linger and ponder. Glance parries glance. Heat splits the furs asunder. Song is born out of wonder. The lark returns to stubble. Stay within the present tense. Indifference brings the barn to rubble. This is a sort of fishing poem. I'm very keen on fishing poems, although I don't do any fishing. It's one of the nice things about poetry is that you can do all sorts of armchair activities. With baited line, I search the shallows, an expanse of slumbering water. My boat loiters under willows, the breezes ripple with laughter. Rhyme procrastinates and hollows, old boots and litter take the fly. So much floats away in life. Imperceptibly, flag petals dry. Purple on the stairs of cloud, silence to set the teeth on edge. You can't fish twice in the same stream. I will give myself to sedge. The cistus blooms again, season of the heart's content. Worlds exist but to endure. Limbs are drowsy with with consent. Take the path swiftly to the lake. Words fail on the brink of sense. There is nothing but air between us. Tact and fear out of air condensed. This is the place of deliberation. A leaf falls from a tree. Briars tug at my sleeve. Antlers struggle to be free. Each surface attends the light, the insistent presence of stone. Embarrassed, stubborn, voracious, the old argument goes on. What bright occasion is this? A shelter for suffering. Lovers prepare themselves. The hour is an offering. Corrupt tears of the world, I speak your name out loud. Candor, rage, duplicity. Business as usual under the cloud. This for some reason reminds me of Verlaine, I'm not sure why. The streets are wet with rain. All day long I have walked and sung. Old loves never return. It is for boldness the bells are rung. Tenderness glistens in the air. I let the chance go by. Old loves litter the gutters. The pavements are impeccably dry. Wind extends a light flag. Slender branches start to sway. The gardens slope down to the sea. It is morning of the first day. This is a sort of southern English landscape. A large and benign calm, a lane that plunges into shade, fold after lunatic fold, the senses tempered like a glade. You need only say the word, a push and the branches yield. Pace yourself and prime yourself. Life is a walk across the field. A door left open on the afternoon. Luncheon spread beneath a tree. An interior proffered like a fruit. In the distance, the tilted sea. This isn't so much a fishing one as a sailing one. Day rose out of mud and reeds, a web of lines and bearings. An anchor rusted in a meadow, a stir of gulls among the saltings. Fresh tar painted on the bows, a tremble in the leech of the sail. A bit of rag at the masthead. Water creaming by the rail. To port a line of withies. To starboard all was new. A path of light in our wake. Rumour rife among the crew. is a gardening poem. The scythe seeks out the slow worm. The heat of noon is malign. Marry resolve to prudence. Be ruthless with the vine. This earth is watered with tears. Each alchemilla proffers a jewel. Go about the season's business. The frost of neglect is cruel. Mortify the budlier. Let not the quince be spared. Detach your heart from the transient. The deep bed is prepared. This is a landscape which I think is probably culled out of various paintings by Watteau. 18th century French landscape. Repose of clouds and waves. Indolent arc of the fountain. Desultory gusts of conversation. Languor, idleness, abandon. The satyr has turned to stone. Morning mocks our lack of poise. Listless with the weight of Saturn, first light offends the eyes. The island pulls at its anchor, a frightful exaction from grace. Day sprawls along the horizon. Let's part with a nonchalant embrace. A tune on a trellis of twigs, tints of gold and tarnished green, across the meadow and over the moor, my companion, the tumbling stream. For he who would comprehend himself, who would the horizon construe, a thoroughfare from here to there, a stretch of exemplary blue. Hugely before my sandals, a uniform space is unfurled, worn out with schemes and stratagems. I take possession of the world. This last one takes place on some imaginary Celtic island in the Middle Ages, I think. A host comes upon the sea. Their oars are timed by song. They sail towards this happy isle. Their landing will not be long. A tired sun goes before them. Their wake is spread with blood. An oath of vengeance binds them. A curse is their only food. Here the colours are primary. The spray drops crystals on the shore. Sweet and clean is the meadow grass. Guile was never known before. That last poem about the island leads me into the next thing, which is a fairly longish prose poem, after which we'll have a break. You can all run away and scream or whatever you like. The image of the island crops up quite a lot in various things that I do. This one is based loosely on the fact that in Celtic legend there are lots of stories about floating islands, or islands that only rise at certain times and then disappear again. It's easy to understand how this kind of legend arose if you think of a typical Irish, Scottish or Welsh landscape with mist appearing over the sea or over hills, hills disappearing and appearing again through mist. And also it's easy to understand it in the time of very rudimentary navigation. Anyway, this is a description of one such floating island. The piece is just called An Island. There are days of exceptional clarity when the curvature of the sun's rays is abnormally strong, and an island just below the horizon will suddenly become visible. The sea is blue, the sparse grass green, the rocks vivid with saffron lichen, the white plumage of waders reflects the boreal intensity of light. Around this island stretches not a sea, but emptiness. There is no place on the island where one can lose the sound of emptiness beating on the shore. Words circumnavigate the island, but caught by invisible currents, they are unable to land. When the sea is calm, the island is calm. When the sea rages, the island is calm. The history of the island has been one of increasing isolation. Over the years, all ties of commerce and culture have been broken and the island set adrift on the waves of its own inertia. The people have pared their desires and expectations to the point where the significance is only to be found in the customary. Island is another word for integrity. On an island, there is nowhere to go. The eyes of the islanders are blue. The systole and diastole of the tide pulses in their veins. The local drink is extracted from malted barley, dried over peat. Its effect is to lend sea legs to the farmer. Over many generations, birds and small mammals have developed indigenous features. The wren is distinguished by its poise. The eyes of mice have an additional luster. The fireside stories of the island rest upon silence as on an oar. Tales and ballads are told with precise inflections. A proverb is dropped into a conversation like a pebble into deep waters. Perhaps the best way to explore the difficult terrain of the island is by bicycle. For every uphill mile, there is a mile of freewheeling. The typical voice of the islands is as strident as a gale. Consonants cluster on the tongue like barnacles. vowels are tuned to the pentatonic scale. Incessant wind disciplines the island, stripping it of attributes. In the lee of the wind, reflection and curiosity are never established. Trees do not flourish on the island, for only a fisherman could stand upright. The days of the week are rack and shingle, dulse and tangle and carrageen. Flotsam is a holiday. Salvage is a day of prayer. The general shape of the island defies easy description. It is like a pebble much worked by the tide. It is like an upturned wreck. It is the shape of a day more harried than usual by ill luck and exasperation. Island jerseys are knitted to strict conventions. Stars appear among thistles. Wave patterns are formalized between anchors and chains. In kale and herring, the island is self-sufficient, and fiddle tunes are the staple of trade. From neighboring islands, the coracles return, laden with jigs and reels. Out on the edge of the world, darkness and excessive light undermine the most resolute, and solitude and silence drive the crofters to alternate bouts of drunkenness and abstinence. Doors left open on the latch, they wait always for a saviour to appear in the guise of a stranger. The weather forecast is always from worse. On the western coast of the island are many secret bays and inlets where a boat may turn into suddenly quiet water. Effort and will that drain out of the mind and body as brightness drips from the lifted oars. In the island street is a shop which sells whiskey and groceries, seed potatoes and fishing tackle. You can buy a sou'wester or a prayer book. You may exchange politeness information. Islanders never make trivial conversation. They talk about the weather. The island will remain remote until you first set foot upon the cliff. As you are poised with the four-hour rope, the mist falls and the mist rises, and the island seems to float before you over the restless waves. Okay. I'm going to read a set of poems called simply 20 Poems. These are coming out as a book from Gross Test Press in a month or so, I hope. They are 20 unrelated poems of various landscapes. I'll just say a word or two about each if it's necessary. Most of it's self-explanatory. The first one is a description of the Golden Age, and it's very much embroidered from a small description in the Chinese philosopher Chuang Tzu. the Chinese, like just about everybody else, have got the myth of the Golden Age, which is a time when people lived in harmony with the world and with each other, without having to work or do anything remotely unpleasant. In those first days, there was no distinction between percept and concept. No bridges spanned the waters, no coulters broke the clay. The people knew nothing of deduction or inference. They did nothing in particular, went nowhere in particular. Wild horses roamed over boundless pasture, kicking their heels or grazing the soft blue grass. There was no division among the golden hours. There was no equation between apples and stars. The third was still a discord. The people lived in concord, and song was accessory to dance. Now and then the lane twists and strikes in a new direction, as if embarking on adventures. One stumbles over villages as over a pebble lodged in the long grass. So still the air about each sense that we can trust its evidence and walk the road with a will. Let us look behind the hill. Bring nothing cumbersome with you, a compass and a song. Dust off your wide awake hat. Lace up your boots with bindweed. The way will not be long. This is a sort of highland landscape. High piled cumulus, a field of snow where no shadow falls, melting as we speak of it. And now the deer climb out of the straths and glens to graze the open mountain. It is the birth of time, of least willow, tufted sedge, and the starry saxifrage. The air is the sport of hours, a lightness may be yours, out on the rubicon of rhyme. Vapour rises from the moss, rivers tear themselves loose. The flute of the ring ouzel, lingering, melts like a snow crystal. Between the pine and the fir, there is a morning of mist, a mist between naked beeches. And though larch boughs lift armfuls of gathered gold, there is mist between larches. I walk in the nave of the mist, turn aside into misty chapels to whisper my ghostly prayers. Through all the Gothic forest, an absence moves among presences, laying deposits of rhyme. Beech and larch and fir and pine each is to the other opaque, clutching rags of mist about them, till separate they struggle away. This is the wind that breaks the broom and strips the furs of blossom. This is the wind of decision. It is a wind without discretion, an intractable wind, an intransigent wind, a wind that blows in one direction. It punishes the thicket and disciplines the break. It blows for its own sweet sake. This is the wind that reaches in to the mountain's granite vein, a wind that rocks the mind with pain. We have no defense against it. We can only lean against it. It will carry off your hat. This is the wind that knows itself and sweeps up all before it. This is the prevailing wind. The fields of long grass, to actually walk in them, wet with persistent dew, and the pine boughs opening onto distances of blue, to sit and look at them, with no particular incident, with no lack of incident, with no end in view. To walk in the grasses, to linger in the forest, and feel it to be true, and to come in at last, pleasantly tired as if from a familiar landscape. Garden description. There comes a day of little wind when the veiled light reaches down to the dogtooth violet through clumps of holly. The first heath grasses triumph over the fading rust of bracken, and among the straggling hellebores, fancy disports with folly. Here the silver stems of birches, banded with their varied browns, glow in conspicuous restraint against the glossy rhododendrons. Here the straightened syntax lengthens until the heart's defences fall, where lavender and centolina meet in an angle of the wall. This poem seems to take place in a Spanish landscape. I'm slightly uncertain because I've never written anything about Spanish landscape. We drive through names that breathe, or whisper of tall acacias, of camellias, or orange trees. But we forbear to know them, rushing for the horizon in our coach and four. Tomorrow we will lie in shade and couple hour with scented hour, or inquire if the rock rose is in flower above the slopes of Asphodel. Tomorrow we will take our ease and rejoice that we could quell today's impetuosities, and the days will again be solemn and strict with the occasion of cicadas and castanets. We will speak of our condition and saunter through a garden lavish with lime blossom and the lack of volition. This poem is an imitation of an early Irish hermit poem. A lot of early Celtic literature comprises very short poems written by religious hermits describing their life in the woods. This is an imitation of one of those. Well roofed and pleasant is my hut in the woods, with its lintel of honeysuckle, with its thatch of faith. Its chimney is veracity, its windows are alacrity. Slow days will I spend there, telling the rosary of the hours. With its warm southern aspect, with its soft singing brook, a few folk of sense about me, prompt will be my husbandry. With psalms for sustenance, with the air for penance, well roofed and pleasant is my hut in the woods. This is, I think, an alpine landscape. The pleasant valleys, the strong rivers, are born out of ice. The kind pastures, the level meadows, innocent of artifice. The candid fields lie bare beneath a wall of granite, and the days pass brilliant, frangible in the stern light. This poem is has a kind of southern French landscape to it. Takes off really from a painting by Matisse in Glasgow Art Gallery called The Pink Tablecloth. The pink tablecloth is spread with choice and mellow fruits, with all your studied candor. One does not live in splendor, but in a straitened magnificence among the windfalls. This is the sporting life where we can lunch and dine and converse without strategy, lit up by Anjou wine. I nod to you from a haze and admire the damask glaze that spreads on your countenance. Delight is our ordinance. Is it evening or dawn that tints the horizon? And this one takes place in the desert. I'm not sure that I can stand all this jumping around, actually. emotionally. Some eaches come again out of the sultry hours to his own prayers, as under deep cliff shadow or thin acacia shade. Tinkers and menders of arms and kettles, paying to all men a petty tribute, they pitch their tents in the mountain air, and no delight on a morning early. These are the pilgrim and precarious ones who wander the immense face of the desert in a land where there is hardly a footprint. They are nourished on the sweet flesh of gazelle. This poem is made up entirely of phrases from the Chinese Zen philosopher Huang Po. It's a description of Zen, what Zen is, or in other words, ultimate reality, or being, or whatever. He proceeds, like many Zen philosophers, in a kind of negative way. And this is something that occurs in Christian religions as well. It's a way of describing God or being in terms of what it isn't. It is not green nor yellow. When the sun rises, it does not get brighter. But when the sun sets, it is not dark. It is motionless, like wood or stone. It has no location. Even its root does not exist. You may think it is near, yet you will never be able to catch it in your hands. Though you were to adorn it, it would only remain the more invisible. Like the sun, it shines without intending to shine. It is a single brilliance. The songs retreat into the shrubbery above limp ditches where the sun pares its fingernails. All over the lawn, prepositions jostle for advantage. The garden wall scintillates with lichen, and the clematis sighs. Distance cleanses the eye. Give up the world. Give up the fore and after. Give up the noise and laughter and step into blue air. The steady motions of the sun and moon too stiffly conform to our presumption. But the body of this air hinders not the light nor the faceted cries from passing through it. Mine was to sleep and again to rise till the cruel shows unlocked my eyes. This is the fruit in the trembling ears. An inquiring wind reaches and tears. We raise ourselves only by affection, and the stars shine to witness affliction. The last stanza in this poem is I had in mind the description of a painting by Caspar David Friedrich of some very 18th century people standing on top of a mountain looking out to sea with a boat on the horizon coming towards them, a large ship. It starts off, the first two lines are taken from a play by Brecht, I think Mahagoni, but I'm not sure. Wonderful is the approach of evening, and beautiful are the conversations that ring within the placid spaces of evening. The cries of immoderate fear, or the shouts of unfounded joy, beat against the brow of the hill and are gone with the curlews. We are not ourselves, but an exchange between hill and valley, an occasion in the middle air. So fine are the transient peninsulas, so lovely the shifting vistas, we take on flesh to watch them. We gaze across air to where, over the settling waves, a brig is bringing music. Under a full moon, the small mammals find their way by paths well hidden from the light of day, through wild gardens, over unkempt lawns. The small wayfarers that trace on the terrace silver lines, camouflaged with candor or bristling with spines, braving the predatory pockets of shadow, they come to the proffered saucer of light. This poem utilizes fairly common poetic device, which is to address abstractions, virtues or feelings or whatever, as if they were concrete persons. In this case, the things addressed are kindness, attention, and gentleness. I am determined to know you, kindness, and to walk with you as far as the garden gate or farther. You could tell me so much before we parted on the edge of another temperate evening. And your friend, attention, with her open face, would walk with us and listen to the space between the worlds. I want to live with you, gentleness, and learn all the domestic details of your day. I would have it spread abroad, wherever the arrogant gather, that I am finally pledged to you. I want to look at you. I want to be with you. I want to discover how to defend you and relinquish you. I love your quiet eyes. Another poem about a journey has lots of them all. You are tired and hungry and far from what you know. Wherever chance has brought you, that's where you want it to go. Access is always permitted. A right of way is defined. But it still remains to negotiate the debris strewn on the ground. No matter how prone to error, wherever your steps may stray, the serrated rim of the mountain goes with you along the way. This is the last one in this bunch. It's a description of turbulence of air. It's the effect of heat rising, causing vibrations. Thus it was that sitting, gazing across vacant air, pale and unsubstantial forms seemed to rise about me out of the heated earth. Springing from the parched grass in their tens and hundreds. Faint they were and slender, a disconsolate multitude, shifting with uncertain motion against the turbulent light. Looking steadily at them, I thought that they might be the shades of sleeping things that had long lain under the matted roots of turf, waiting upon an appointed time to gather in the light of day. I think that's about all I'm capable of tonight. Thank you. Wants to throw at me either money or abuse. I'm a sitting target. Thank you, anyway. Worried about the chairs
here. Yeah, we had an island, yes, and it was lovely.
Why are you worried about it?
I thought it was funny. It was not meant to be funny,
I'm sorry. What's that?
The convention. The jersey.
I didn't know. I didn't know why it's problematical or why you're worried about it. You think it's maybe lying out there in the rain or something?
No, because the jersey comes from a specific island, which is a Channel Island.
Oh my God.
A Guernsey comes from Guernsey, which is another specific Channel Island style, like the one you're wearing. And you're using it as a generic for this imaginary island, which is actually supposed to be sort of situated somewhere off the Outer Hebrides or something.
My God.
It was an Irish jumper.
It's Chedgy to jumper.
Yes.
I mean, it's important about naming.
Yes, that's a very precise point. I hadn't taken that at all. I think I have to humbly apologise for that. I'm taking that as a generic term rather than a specific. But
remember the D.H. Lawrence once answered a question like that saying, you may well be right.
I can't even answer that. I'm sure you're right.
Well, I just mention it because it kind of bothered me for the next sort of paragraph or two.
The last time I read A Poem About an Island, you asked a question which bothered me for months until I suddenly realised the answer to it. There's a line in 16 Sonnets which says, I will be an island in the sea. And you said to me, well, that's absolutely bloody redundant, that is. Why in the sea? Every island's in the sea. I thought, my God, such a lax writer I am. Back to the drawing board. And in fact, of course, every island isn't in the sea. And the reason I write, particularly I write, I will be an island in the sea, is because I was born and grew up in a landscape surrounded by islands, but they're all freshwater islands. So I'm not having any islands. I'll have to do some research on Jersey. That's right, yes. I think that was what I said.
Well, it wasn't really an attack, it was simply pointing out that he liked using clichés in modern schools and contemporary poetry.
Should I revive a cliché, refreshing cliché?
Yes, I
would
use a cliché, very refreshing.
I think that the reason that it was used was, that particular cliché was because it was a cliché. I will be an island and see, it's an almost conventional phrase. But nevertheless, there is a precise thing behind it. Damn it, the manuscript's at the printer as well.
I'm so sorry. It's funny, Aaron's just stood out for you. It's just because, we're listening anyway. You do sort of, what I say, miss a certain...
Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of anomalies in it, of course, and if you wanted to look at it too strictly, and that being taking place in mythic time, it's also in a mythic location. You've got sort of coracles and bicycles and all sorts of anomalous things.
And yes, you can accept that. There's a coracle I did this sort of associated with the Channel Islands.
No, I mean, you...
But at the point, the details of the island are not imaginary, which is why the island itself dissipates more and more. The island itself ceases to exist after this description.
Can I ask you, I mean, how conscious are you writing for your own voice? When you were reading, I've always lived in cities, urban, yeah. Conscious, and a lot of I don't have this kind of shared sort of symbolism of the countryside. But I mean, it struck me listening to you that you could not have read it, and certainly probably could not have written it had you got, I don't know, let's say a really deep Glaswegian accent or a Liverpudlian accent.
Yeah.
I mean, are you conscious of your own phonetic sound in your own head when you're writing?
A voice in a very, again, a very conventionalised sense. I mean, I suppose I have some idea of my own voice, but I'm much more aware of other voices in the writing. Any given poem is a sort of binding together of all sorts of voices. The line, I will be an island in the sea, is obviously a rhetorical one. So one's aware of a certain rhetorical, conventional, poetic voice. I think that I'm much more aware of a conventional poetic voice than I am my own specific voice. And indeed, I think that probably when I come to read them, my own sense is a sense of inadequacy, that I don't actually live up to the various voices that are in the poem. And that's a continual source of frustration in the reading. I think that probably one couldn't read those poems in a sort of Billy Connolly way. I'm sure that's true.
But the way that you read your own work must probably influence the way that you write your own work.
Yeah, well. Sure.
I think really that's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I mean,
sure.
You have some notion of how you yourself are going to speak the lines.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it strikes me that it's more the sort of the tempo really of the pace. It seems just to suit. I mean, we haven't really met you this evening, but if you're talking about voices, is that seem that it's more of the way that you know that one would feel that that's the things that you're describing involved in, but the way that they move and the pace that they move at.
Yes.
And I mean, is there anything that you write that whereby that there is a more of a sense of urgency or
frenetic?
Yes. I mean, I don't know. You see.
Look, I mean, you use a quote from Brecht, and he struck me as old. I mean, it doesn't quite strike me as your poet somehow, Brecht.
Didn't read them a lot, I must say. It's very difficult for me to say because my work's in constant flux, and I'm always aware that anything I might say about it is largely about where it was rather than where it might be going. But certainly I tend to see my poetry as being the poetry of stillness and to be about lack of movement. It's always been, in some sense, a problem for me as a writer, in that the work always tended to move towards a stasis, which is problematical because poetry is an unfolding art. It's an art that happens in time, and I've always attempted to hold it and stop it. And, it's one reason why I've written very short things with only two or three words on them, stuck on the wall, because of frustrated painter to a degree. So, I mean, I think there are probably poems that are more frenetic than others, but it's a freneticism within a very narrow range.
Because actually, for me, the art, if you're talking about you're hoping for really stasis or lack of movement, because you can help the art for me wasn't moving. It was presented to me. Consequence. I mean, it was for me. It's quite sort of, if I use the word riveting, but it did hold my attention. That's the wrong word, but it's proximate to it. Hence, I wasn't sort of affected or offended by the as a con. But I mean, you know, that's how you avoid it. Attention is for the but that's a joke.
I'm
talking
about the trivial as well.
About the
trivial.
I can't even remember what.
They have the trivial conversation. They talk about
the conversation. Oh, I know what
you mean.
No. What is that? Really?
Weather isn't trivial, is it?
Well,
yeah. Yeah.
Reading kind of radical feminists who kind of.
There aren't many on this island.
The trivial is a kind of, you know, one of these suppressed words.
Would
suppressed
be
meaning. Yes. I mean, this used to be where the three goddesses were. You know, it's an important place. It's only in our culture reduced to this trivial state.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
This was worrying me as well, because, I mean, the way you're so interested in etymology of words, and, I mean, the way words reflect on other possible texts, and other possible poetic voices and traditions, and so on. And then I had to actually cut out one whole kind of series of, you know, possible associated meaning.
Of the word trivial?
Yeah. I'm sorry about
I mean, surely what it's saying, I mean, it's like we're saying, it isn't exactly trivial. It's a certain tension about using that particular word. You know, it creates, I mean, I don't know how to articulate, but I don't find that actually saying that something is trivial, saying the opposite in fact.
Oh, I mean, it's an argumentative phrase.
That's
right.
It just had so many repercussions. I wondered whether.
But I mean,
the audience response.
I mean, how interested are you in the etymology of, you know, Artemis and the trivial?
I hadn't.
It hadn't struck me much.
It's It's not always at my elbow, I must say, but in that particular piece, it certainly wasn't.
I mean, it's not, I mean, what I thought you were doing there was actually moving outside and you were giving an outsider's view of the island, mm-hmm. which you then immediately contradict by saying it's trivial to talk about the weather, and of course the sort of the irony is immediate, yeah. isn't it? But of course yeah. the weather isn't trivial
yes.
for people, yeah. for fishermen or people living on the island.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very much an argumentative countryman's view of things that... you know, it's only really people who are very far removed from the weather who think of it as trivial.
They talk about it even more.
In order to it gets over the countryman's view of things. So in the first bit of dedication, there was one line about the measurement of strain or something.
Measure stress and quantity.
Yes. Which sounded very technological.
I don't think it's specifically meant to be technological. It's, I mean, the narrow meaning is measure stress and quantity being poetic terms, you know, poetic measure, poetic stress and quantity. It's to measure stress and quantity. It's sort of saying that it's celebrating that rather than kind of loose.
To measure the
bird,
but to
measure.
Yes, measure.
Yeah,
stress.
I see.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean that specifically is much more. It means narrowly poetic terms rather than. I'm not dedicating it to stress in the sense of, you know, tearing your hair out or whatever. I must slightly scotch the idea that I write about the country, which I don't. I'm not a describer of landscapes by any means. I use some natural symbolism, mostly because my inclination is that way, but also very deliberately because that is the traditional symbolism of English poetry. Therefore, it's a very heavily loaded one. And it has repercussions through the history of writing and so forth. And since all my work is very highly allusive, for me, the urban landscape is much more a landscape of now, of the present, rather than, it doesn't have that kind of literary richness to it. Sorry.
Like you get the sure. Hausman, which is a sort of the urban man's romantic
yes.
view of the countryside.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's very little in it of the unpleasant side of the countryside, if there any way.
None whatsoever.
I mean
that's,
you don't get the thing that occurs
yeah,
to me coming from a town, the moment you step onto a farm,
yes.
is the obvious. You know, it's the smell and
knee deep
in horseshoe.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's none of that.
Sure,
so in a
yeah.
sense, it's idealised.
Well, very much so. I mean, it's very deliberately idealised. That's why I say it's not about the country at all. It's about an idealised landscape. It's the landscape of ideas, really. Ideas and feelings and so forth. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, one talks about a landscape, not for the sake of the landscape, but to play on the feelings. I mean, the opposite end of the scale for me as a writer would be a writer like Ted Hughes, who writes very much about, I mean, there are charming poems about sticking your hand up a cow's arse. And, I mean, that's poetry about the countryside.